We're back with another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor here at the Federalist. As always, you can email the show at radio@thefederalist.com. Follow us on Twitter at FDRLST. Make sure to subscribe wherever you download your podcasts as well. Today, we're talking big tech, one of the most important and I would say frequently covered subjects on this podcast, but for good reason. And I'm joined today by my friend Claire Morrell. Claire is a policy analyst at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, where she runs EPPC's Big Tech Project. Prior to joining EPPC, Claire worked in both the White House Counsel's Office and the Department of Justice, as well as both in the private and nonprofit sectors. Her work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Times, Newsweek, here at the Federalist, and also in National Review. Claire, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be on. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, I want to start by talking about a piece you have out in National Review pretty recently. You wrote, "Parents, are you prepared for the digital dangers your kids face?" And this is such an important question. I think everybody knows that. But your answer, as you sort of answer this question, you're a parent yourself, the answer is, I think, probably a little more frightening than most parents are prepared to admit. I don't know. Maybe I'm overstating that. But when you start to describe some of the real threats and how pervasive they are, it seems to me that we're wildly unprepared to confront some of these. Could you talk to us about how you answer this question? Are American parents prepared for the digital dangers facing children right now?
Absolutely. And you're spot on in that I think that parents are generally aware, they have a sense that being on smartphones and social media isn't the best for kids. They recognize that these devices are very addictive and kids can just quickly get glued to screens. So I think there's a general awareness. And, you know, increasingly the media is covering this and it's become more of an interest in Congress about the harms to kids from social media platforms. But I do think parents aren't quite aware the level of kind of harmful content that circulates on a lot of the social media apps that their children are on, like sexual and illicit content, also drug content, just really a lot of violence. And then I think a particular concern to conservatives, there's a ton of LGBTQ content being promoted on these social media platforms. They're full of these quote unquote trans influencers. And so I think a lot of parents naively assume that kids are mainly on there interacting with their peers and just looking at kind of fun and entertaining content. And they recognize that they should probably put time limits on these devices so their kids aren't glued to screens all day. But I'm really not sure they're quite aware and prepared for just the level of harmful content on these platforms, even stuff like eating disorders and just how quickly kids can get sucked down these rabbit holes based on the algorithms that these apps use to operate.
And what it does to your brain as well. I mean, there's a very sort of chemical reaction that we know more and more and we're learning more and more about. And I think that's how you just described it is so interesting that there's this among parents. And I think this is changing, you know, just by the minute every single day. But this idea that it's almost like TV, you know, you put time limits on it. You make sure that there are, you know, content limitations, you know, the R-rated things are not easily accessible, you know, have pornography blockers, et cetera, et cetera. But first of all, on the internet, those things are very easy to circumvent. And secondly, yeah, there's something just much different, I think, going on with the way it affects young people's brains in terms of, you know, our dopamine reactions, in terms of our attention spans and all of that.
No, you're precisely right. It's not exaggerating to say that these apps are rewiring kids' brains. Particularly between the ages of like 10 to 12, kids' dopamine receptors are just multiplying. And this is a good thing because it helps to have kids' brains wired for quote unquote social rewards, which helps them interact with their peers, engage socially. It's a good thing. But these dopamine receptors are getting just hijacked by these social media platforms that are designed and wired to set up all these social rewards for kids. And so they're becoming addicted to, you know, the notifications, the kind of instant content, all the likes, the posts from their friends is really rewiring their brains. And adults also have dopamine receptors and we kind of respond the same way to social media. It's why they become so addictive. But But adult brains have a more developed, what they call the prefrontal cortex, which is where your impulse control, self-control, emotional regulation happens. And so we are able to not act as impulsively. We are able to better regulate our emotions. But kids, just their brains are not fully developed. And it's why it's so dangerous, really, for the mental health of kids and teens, which is why we've seen this spike in these rates of depression, anxiety, self-harm, even suicides, really from like 2013 to 2018, which is right around the time of when Facebook bought Instagram and make that platform much more addictive and social media took off. And so while you can't, you know, say that it's a direct cause, like you couldn't call it causation, there's a really strong correlation. These things line up around the same times that we see these mental health effects in kids as social media is becoming more popular and addictive.
Claire, I mentioned in the introduction that you worked for the Trump administration in various roles, and I wanted to ask how you ended up sort of specializing in big tech. You're one of the most interesting people to talk to on the right because you really do specialize in this. It's not just sort of a hobby horse for you that you dip in and out of, you know, when it's relevant. This is something you're deeply familiar with and you do work on every single day. You run EPPC's Big Tech Center, which, by the way, every like conservative organization should have, because it's, you know, it's we think of tech as something that's kind of tangential or its own little category, but it is now every single category because we do everything on tech. So it is just the probably the most important filter to look at the world through going forward. But for you, how did you end up specializing in tech?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think, you know, like a lot of people in Washington, D.C., a kind of nonlinear path to how I ended up here. But through working, it was really the end of my time at the administration. I was working for Attorney General Barr in his front office, and he was just increasingly growing concerned about big tech and their outsized influence really in our lives, and particularly just how they were able to get away with censorship and suppression of free speech, particularly of conservatives, because of their Section 230 immunity and how that had been expanded and wrongly interpreted. And so he put together a Section 230 task force and meeting that they held to really analyze what changes needed to be made to that law, particularly to hold platforms accountable for knowingly allowing criminal content like sexual exploitation of children and obscenity to just circulate on their platforms, but also how they were wrongly using and hiding behind the vague terminology in that law, otherwise objectionable, getting protections for removing content that is otherwise objectionable, to say that certain conservative viewpoints were objectionable content. So he really drilled down on that. And that's when I first started to get exposed to just the extent of which, to your point, big tech is now pervading all of these other areas because it's our new public square. And this is where conversations are happening. And so for the right to win all these other policy battles we're fighting, you know, the most fundamental thing we need to address is whether we're having equal access to today's modern public square. And so that was my kind of first exposure and foray into the big tech space, as well as he really also emphasized looking into antitrust violations by these big tech companies. And while I was there, they filed the big kind of DOJ lawsuit against Google. And so I was peripherally aware of that as well. And so basically, once the administration ended, I got connected to EPPC and they wanted to start up a big tech project. And given my background and bio, they asked if that's something I'd be interested in working on. And no one else at that point really had a big tech project going. Since then, I think more conservative organizations have jumped in on this fight. And so that was in March of 2021, we started this project up. And just by studying these issues every day and really focusing on this, I've, you know, developed more of an expertise on the big tech front. And increasingly, we're starting to look more at the harms to kids. You know, it's not just their censorship and suppression of speech that's concerning, but also harms to kids and families, as well as this growing epidemic of online pornography, are also areas I'm increasingly focusing on.
Well, and that's so much worse than the censorship in every way. It's not to say that the censorship isn't there and isn't wrong, but it's to say that this is first order. I mean, the way that these devices are in everybody's pockets and are accessible to children every single day in this country and rewiring their brains every single day in this country is orders of magnitude more important than the censorship from my position on it. And I wanted to ask Claire if you read the New York Times issued a series of mea culpa last week, things we were wrong about. Their columnists, from Gail Collins to Brett Stevens. Gail Collins said she was wrong to talk so much about Mitt Romney strapping his dog to the top of his car, and Brett Stevens said he was wrong about Trump. And their tech columnist said that he was wrong about, I think, Twitter and Facebook, or at least Facebook, that he was basically naive in the early Obama years to cheerlead for tech. He wasn't at the New York Times back then, but sort of look back on his old columns and was sort of, there was a naivete about what tech would do and what it could do and sort of inevitably where it would take us. And I'm wondering if you think that was similarly an attitude that policymakers had. You know, how did we get suckered in to this sort of utopian Silicon Valley fantasy world where Twitter is solving world peace? You know, the Iranian revolution, Twitter was supposedly going to bring democracy to Iran. And same thing with the Arab Spring. They were all in the mix in the conversation about, you know, creating a better world and a better world. How did this happen? How did this go so wrong if we look back, you know, more than a decade ago and reflect on the way people talked about tech?
It's a really insightful question. I think it's probably complex in that there's multiple factors that go into that. But I will say that I think in general, you are correct in that. I think policymakers just kind of willingly, we all kind of willingly embraced this technology and saw that, you know, this was going to be a great thing, that we were all going to be so connected on these platforms. It was going to allow us to have conversation and stay in touch with people. And, you know, it kind of almost gets to that kind of globalist perspective that I feel like policymakers have had for a while. I mean, it's traditionally, I think, been championed a lot on the left, this kind of like globalism that we'll all be connected. But I think, you know, many on the right embraced that too. And I think now we're seeing a reaction that, wait a second, maybe it wasn't so good to hand over so much power in our kind of discourse to these Silicon Valley elite big tech companies who clearly have a political bias and their own political agendas. You know, they're not providing a neutral public square. And it's not just about connecting people. You know, their algorithms are specifically promoting and suppressing certain viewpoints and certain content. But because the conversations and our interactions have shifted so much online, you know, it's really then that's harmful. In terms of how we're able to advance our policies and conversations, you have to be on these platforms. And that's, you know, a lot of the reason too, there's been so much attention on antitrust is that there's not opportunity for competitors to break into these spaces and provide alternative outlets. You know, look at Parler. They tried to do that. And then, you know, colluding together, Apple and Google dropped them from their app stores and Amazon canceled their web services, their supporting infrastructure. And so it's, you know, they were kind of the ones who got their foot in the door first, like Facebook and, Google and Amazon. And so now, you know, it's really impossible for alternatives to break into these spaces to provide a more open, you know, marketplace of ideas. And so we're kind of left with trying to now rein back the power that was given to these big tech companies, you know, both by policymakers, I think, and not rightly kind of being more cautious in trying to regulate them more carefully from the beginning. And I think also, though, just as a culture, we just kind of embraced them. And I think only now, kind of 10 years later, as we're seeing these effects, people are kind of waking up to, wow, maybe we just too quickly kind of moved our lives onto these platforms when we shouldn't have. So I don't know if that fully answered your question, but I think it is, it's something that I think people are now really realizing what we've done.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because recently one of the things, and this is, more abstract, and it's not totally policy related, but one of the things people have been, I've heard it from more and more folks. Facebook recently it's going to more of a TikTok, Instagram Reels model on the newsfeed. I'm sure you saw that, Claire, mm-hmm. because you follow this so closely. Yeah, but yeah. The newsfeed that we've become accustomed to, which I'm sure, Claire, you remember like I do. Neither of us is that old, but we are the Facebook generation. When you were writing on people's walls, I remember there used to be a way to email, to write on people's walls via email, which I would do during high school through my like little track phone. I would send an email to post on somebody's wall. But the newsfeed is now becoming more sort of content and bringing video content and bringing people from all over the world into your feed as opposed to people that you know, which is fascinating to me because it exacerbates a problem that social media has really created, which is the overwhelming psychological toll of interacting with people outside of a geographical community. And there's so many benefits to interacting with people. Just the incentives when you're interacting with people in your own community are different. You are accountable to people for better and for worse, and that changes your behavior and shapes your behavior in different ways than when you're talking to people or you're making political statements for people all over the world. You're reaching out to, let's say, if you're talking about some of the trans influencers, reaching out to people in different corners of the country for support or solidarity or worse. And that's really unnatural and I think really frightening. And it's the psychological toll as well of being able to or being confronted with all of the tragedies everywhere in the world when you open up your device. We could hypothetically solve every social problem in this country, every fiscal problem in this country, and with social media still be confronted every single day with the inevitable tragedies in different corners of the world. And that's really, and in history too. You can go back and, read and look at pictures of historical tragedies at any given time. It's really difficult, and I think it's really caused us to have a lack of perspective. And on this question of TikTok and Facebook, the TikTokification of Facebook, Claire, what should parents be on the lookout for as social media sort of goes increasingly in that direction of the TikTokification of bringing us sort of video content from outside of our own communities, our own social networks, but a global social network?
No, that's really exactly the concern that I have is that you're right. Facebook really used to just like connect you with your friends, and that has it had positive benefits, but we were very much grounded in our local communities. And I think, teen years are always this questioning time for kids. They're really kind of entering the world, preparing for adulthood. It's a time where they're kind of encouraged to do risky things with their friends. But before, there were always these kind of restraining factors, like your parents, and often kids would, with their questions and big life thoughts, go talk to their parents and ask them those questions. Or they would, if they did risky things with their friends, at least they're doing things in person. And there's always someone who would be like, okay, that's like a little too far. Or, they wouldn't say things to each other in person, that they would on the way that they can now really kind of hide behind the screen and just say really horrific things to each other online. And so they were grounded in real life, in-person relationships in their communities. But you're right that now with social media, it's not even like you have to go looking for others, videos or posts. These algorithms are actively dumping this into your feed, as you're mentioning, this TikTokification. And if you watch like one video, it's going to just generate like hundreds of other videos similarly for you to watch from people all over the world, these strangers that don't know you, that don't have your best interests at heart. I mean, your parents and your friends care about you. They care about the person that you're becoming, not so with these internet voices out there. And I think, activists, particularly these LGBTQ activists, have seen that they can use these platforms really to their advantage. And so they've taken to the online world to recruit more followers, especially youth, to join their cause and become their allies. And so they're preying really on the vulnerability of children to convince them of the validity and normalcy of, honestly, their radical sexually perverted lifestyles. And so influencers are actively working to undermine parents' own authority over their children and to really replace the loving influence of parents in children's lives with their own welcoming and accepting community. And so it's unbelievable that, you know, by just logging onto these platforms and just being on their newsfeed, kids are going to be just inundated with these outside voices trying to recruit them to their movement and their cause and, you know, kind of selling them these lies that, you know, if you feel uncomfortable in your body or feel like you don't belong, just transition your gender and it will solve all your problems. Join us. Don't listen to your parents. You know, your parents, you can lie to them. And so they're really actively trying to undermine those traditional authority structures and relationships that are in our lives. And they're able to, because these platforms are just giving them an infinite audience and really infinite access, especially to young kids who are much more easily influenced at this kind of current age. And then on the other note of just the news feed being full of just depressing news from around the world, it's just hard for kids, especially, you know, younger kids, and they're kind of very innocent hearts and minds to just be inundated with so much heavy news, really. And that, I think, is also contributing to this rise in depression. And then also just kind of the infinite comparison. Like, girls are being, you know, just shown all of these, you know, models and picture perfect people with these filters on. And so it used to just be you were kind of comparing yourself to your local pool of girls at your high school. And now it's just an infinite amount of people you're comparing yourself to. And so it's contributing to the anxiety in teen girls, you know, as well as eating disorders and body image issues, just really a drastic increase from what it used to be. You know, and I think Abigail Schreier hits on this too in her book, Irreversible Damage, that infinite comparison and to kind of these high standards of beauty online are also really driving the kind of disturbing trend of teen girls transitioning. Because if you think, I can never achieve that standard of beauty, I feel uncomfortable in my body, maybe it's because I'm the wrong gender then, and I should just transition and become a boy, and that will solve my problem. Because what young teen in the throes of navigating puberty and body changes, as well as these hard peer social dynamics, feels totally comfortable in their body and confident in who they are? So I think influencers are also just preying on that and seeing that these girls are really ripe for recruiting to the trans cause.
Mm. That's just an overwhelmingly sad prospect given how pervasive these technologies are and how ingrained they are in our everyday lives, which is kind of what I wanted to ask you about next, because it does seem to me almost a Herculean task of disentangling ourselves from an unhealthy relationship with tech at this point, because we've transferred so much of our personal lives mm-hmm. onto these devices. And, you know, as we always say here, it's both that culture is downstream of politics and that politics is downstream of culture. They both influence mm-hmm. each other, and there are policy solutions that can help people have a healthier relationship with tech. And Claire, I'm curious as to what you think some of those are. I know you've done work on antitrust and Section 230, but what are some of those big ticket policy solutions that you think would help improve the culture when it comes to tech in this country?
It's a great question. I think there are a lot of ways to go at this. So I would first say there's no silver bullet. We kind of need to use all the policy tools in our tool belt and go at this from several different angles. You know, so antitrust is one, trying to address, how did these companies get to be so big? You know, were there violations of antitrust law, their anti-competitive behavior, in the sense that I think, you know, reining in some of their outsized market dominance would allow other competitors to break through to provide kind of alternative platforms that are better for us that, you know, could compete, you know, like conservative platforms, you know, maybe also just places that recognize the kind of addictive nature of algorithms and are intentionally trying to create more of a non-addictive platform. So antitrust certainly, I think, can help address some of these problems, you know, on a larger scale by just really opening the market up for competition. And so giving users more of a choice of the kind of platform they want to be on. Whereas now you're really kind of forced onto the major platforms. And then the second thing you mentioned is Section 230. I think you know, it may be difficult in the near term to reach agreement on reforms to that law, but there are several things that I think with just a few word changes can make a big difference. Like I mentioned, the term otherwise objectionable that is currently in the kind of what they call Good Samaritan provision, which means that these companies are protected as when they are acting as Good Samaritans and taking down content that is obscene or lewd, lascivious, or excessively violent and harassing. And then the last word in that phrase is otherwise objectionable. And that's where the platforms have been really hiding behind that to take down conservative content, what they call quote unquote misinformation. And so just clarifying that term and, you know, removing that vague language would make a big difference, you know, as well as, you know, AG Barr and his proposal kind of proposed this bad Samaritan carve out so that platforms that are knowingly allowing criminal content like trafficking, drug trafficking, child online exploitation to proliferate on their platforms would also then not get 230 immunity for knowingly allowing criminal content on their platform. So just a few changes like that can make a big difference. And then the last thing I'll say just on the harms to kids that I've been focusing on more recently is there's certainly several policy approaches we could take there. And I think that would be really the place to start, particularly if you're talking about getting something passed soon. I think there's the most kind of bipartisan interest on protecting our kids online. And so the main law to look to there is the Children Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, which was passed in 1998. So yes, it's like a very old law that needs to be updated to what the modern era of the internet looks like. And the main thing is that right now, platforms can collect data without parental consent on kids 13 and up. And so that's why the age for getting on social media has been set at 13, is because that's and when these companies are legally allowed to collect data on kids, which is how they operate and run their platforms. And so just raising the age to 18 or even 16, you know, past kind of those most vulnerable years of kids' brain development would also make a big difference and help keep kids off social media platforms at these younger ages. You know, there's other things they could do to kind of change the current liability standard of that law to make it more enforceable. And so I've written on that. You can find that on my Scholar page at EPPC if you want to read more of the nitty-gritties on how we could update those laws. So those are just a few of the ways that we could really kind of take action and kind of take back the internet into a version that, you know, we know would better promote the common good and values we have of family and connectivity in a healthy way that's grounded in local community, and that's an open and free marketplace of ideas that conservatives can have equal access to in making their viewpoints known.
The Senate right now, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer's daughters work for Amazon and Meta, and the Senate is right now debating a piece of legislation aimed at basically competitiveness in big tech. We've covered it here with senior editor Christopher Bedford a little bit.
Yes.
And, you know, that has been almost a good glimpse, and I'm curious as to whether you agree, into the prospect of legislation that reins in the power of big tech on Capitol Hill, because people like you do identify clear policy solutions, and policy solutions that, for the most part, are overwhelmingly bipartisan in their mm-hmm. potential. And this Republican Party is much more sort of friendly to the idea or favorable to the idea that tech is overstepping the boundaries of free market capitalism, that, you know, those boundaries exist in order to protect the free market and competitiveness in the free market, and the tech industry is overstepping it and needs to be reined in. So the Republican Party and the Democratic Party should both in theory be more favorable to this idea that tech does need to be reined in, and there are policy solutions that can absolutely do that. I'm curious whether you think, or what you think the prospect is of, let's say, you know, this Congress, a Republican Congress, you know, people are expecting Republicans to win the House in the fall, perhaps also the Senate. There may be the presidency in play in 2024. do you, as you're working on these policy solutions, talking to people in the conservative movement, talking to people in the policy space, talking to people on Capitol Hill, what's your sense of whether any of this legislation or any of these policy solutions are really possible or plausible going forward?
Yes, this is the question I ask myself every day. I really like to be an eternal optimist and think that we'll be able to pass some of these bills that seem so clear, you know, that we should, that there would be bipartisan agreement. But then I always feel like at the end of the day, these party dynamics come into play and, you know, people aren't able to put aside some just stupid political things in order to like pass good legislation that makes logical sense. And so I'm not as optimistic. I really thought that Senator Schumer was going to bring the American Innovation Choice Online Act you mentioned to a floor vote. It seemed like there was momentum for that. And now it just kind of feels like it's probably not going to get a vote before the midterms. And it's interesting. There's kind of this narrow window, it almost feels like, that's closing on some of the bipartisan antitrust stuff, in the sense that I think that when Republicans likely win back the House after the November elections, they're not going to have necessarily the appetite for some of these current bipartisan antitrust measures. And they might have their own Republican versions, but then those would not likely get signed into law by President Joe Biden. And so it almost feels like, you know, if there isn't a floor vote soon on the American Innovation Act, then likely I don't expect any bipartisan antitrust reform to have a chance of passing until like 2024. And at that point, I'm not even saying it would be bipartisan. It might hopefully be maybe then like a Republican version of overhauling the antitrust law. And listen, I'll be honest, like, I don't think that the bill is perfect. Like, there's valid reasons that Republicans have concerns for it. But I do fear, and I'm not saying that you know, there isn't reason to have healthy caution about different approaches that may empower the FTC, which I know is a big concern for people. It's an independent agency, and so we don't necessarily want them making all the rules to update our antitrust law. But I think just in general, sometimes on Capitol Hill, the perfect becomes the enemy of the good on a lot of these things. And so anyway, that's a question I'm always asking myself, is like, okay, it's not our ideal version, but if we don't kind of come to consensus on something, then we won't ever pass anything. And that just continues to allow big tech to get away with their current behavior. I have a little bit more hope, I would say, on the harms to kids front. You know, Senator Blackburn and Blumenthal introduced a bill called the Kids Online Safety Act. It's actually getting marked up this morning by the Senate Commerce Committee. And I'm hopeful that that will pass out of the committee. Now, whether or not that'll advance to a floor vote or not before these midterms, I don't know. But I am hopeful that they can kind of keep moving the ball forward, even, you know, after the midterms, to try to get something passed to protect kids. I do think there's more of an appetite for that on both sides. And again, I don't think, you know, any piece of legislation is going to be feel perfect to either side at this point, especially if we have a divided government with a Republican Congress and a Democrat in the White House. We're going to have to try to find ground that we can agree on to at least start to make a difference to protecting kids. So that's kind of my current assessment, is I would like to be more optimistic, but it does kind of feel like partisan interests often just stall these things and then they kind of die out. And I really hope that doesn't happen. And I kind of urge Republicans in Congress to be more willing to work with the Democrats while they have the White House on some of these things, you know, to start somewhere, even if it's not our ideal arrangement.
Yeah, and that's brings us to the second sort of category of solution. If you have legislative solutions, that means you also have market solutions. And the market solution would stem from demand. And so as you're working with, or you're working to think about policy solutions, I know you also, for instance, have a full guide for parents on the EPPC website to raise a family in the digital age. It's a technology guide. I have it open right in front of me right now. It's absolutely fantastic. It's at eppc.org. And so I wanted to ask on the flip side about your optimism or lack of optimism when it comes to convincing us as, you know, actors in the free market, convincing the public to treat tech much more carefully, to limit their use of tech. We see some tech companies responding to this in ways, you know, we have TikTok giving people the ability to limit their time or to add some sort of timer, which they do in China in a very different way, but that's another story. It's a totally different story, where they totally have banned video games. But we see some companies responding to this, trying to offer consumers these tools they know they're not going to turn on, basically, because they've created products that are addictive. We see Apple, you know, doing that with screen time alerts and privacy. They are responding to some consumer demands, but not in ways that I think would substantially alter the addictiveness of their products so far. But we can, as consumers, take those steps. And part of your tech guide is encouraging parents, you know, the places to look for where they might take those steps, the concrete kind of hard roadmap out of this addiction that so many of us have without even really realizing it, because it's just become all consuming and it's where we do, you know, so much of our lives personally and professionally. How optimistic are you about, you know, that sort of demand, the public shifting its demand for tech products, or is it almost too late? Are we so addicted that we're the proverbial frog in the boiling water, where we don't realize we're boiling till we're scalded? Or do you feel like, you know, the more you talk about this, the more you provide clear solutions, clear pathways for parents and for people in general, you know, the closer we're getting to a better place?
Yeah, I am more optimistic, honestly, on the kind of culture side of this, in that I think because now we're seeing the effects of these social media apps come out over time, like we've had them now for about 10 years, we're starting to see the data. You know, Jonathan Haidt and Gene Twenge have put out a lot of data on the harms to kids. So I think there's growing public awareness that these things are dangerous to children and dangerous to us. And so I think we're starting to see like a tech lash, or, you know, kind of a backlash against some of these technologies that, unfortunately, the parents who had their kids, you know, using these technologies kind of as they were coming out are really the ones who've been worst hit because they just didn't know. But now, you know, 10 years later, I think parents who are parenting kids and teens today are much more informed and are able to kind of take steps to put boundaries in place. Because right now, you know, as you mentioned, the parents are the ones really on the front lines who can protect their kids. The companies are starting to offer more, you know, parental control options, quote unquote, but it's very interesting. Right now, they still flow from the child to the parent. So your child has to give you, you know, access to put those controls in place, and they can revoke them at any time. So it will at least send you a notice, like for Instagram, like, oh, your kid decided to default out of the parental controls. But it's still very much child-led and directed. So it's hard. Like, parents can't, I don't think, really use the in-app kind of parental controls very effectively. And so to that end, I think parents should be willing to kind of take steps to protect their kids, you know, on their own. There's several softwares available at pretty low cost per month to parents. These kind of parental control software apps like Bark is one, Circle is another, as well as filtering softwares like Canopy. And there's others that we recommend in our guide, kind of saying, listen, parents, you can utilize practical tools of your own to really try to protect your kids in the meantime, while the companies aren't really accountable for doing this. And I think also, I would say that we would just kind of tell parents to consider completely keeping their children off of all social media until they're 18 or at least 16. And that's not a popular opinion. And I think it's difficult, right? You have to fight those individual battles with your kids then.
But do you think that's getting more popular? Like, the more you talk about it, do you hear more people being like, oh, absolutely?
I do think it's increasing. And I think I honestly would say, like, the more parents that do it, the easier it becomes to do it, you know, because part of the problem is like every kid's like, well, but all the other kids are on it. So I kind of almost feel like parents really need to band together and be like, let's keep our kids off these devices, because it makes the individual battle then for each parent a little bit easier if there's a broader kind of social effect of everyone starting to kind of rein these in for their own kids. And so I kind of want to say, like, parents, start a movement. Like, just if you kind of keep your kids off until you're friends, hey, keep your kids off, you know, like kind of talk about these things together, I think there'd be much more of an effect in terms of being able to keep kids off and making those battles less kind of costly on each parent. But definitely delay social media as long as possible at all costs, especially the most dangerous platforms like TikTok and Instagram. There's just no benefit for kids to be on these, and there's really only harms. And so I think, you know, the more you can delay that, the better. As well as, I would say, this is something we touch on in the guide as well, you know, there's really no reason to let your kid have a smartphone. There's plenty alternative phone options that don't have access to the internet or apps that you can use to still stay in touch with your child. But this near kind of constant access to social media that smartphones provide, it's just a temptation too powerful for kids to have in their pocket. And so, you know, those are some things. And then our guide just kind of tries to give parents advice about kind of what boundaries to put in place around the use of devices, technology in the homes, how to have those conversations with your kids, and then tries to list a bunch of these, you know, practical tools, parental controls that you can put in place. You know, kind of the default ones that are already included that are a good start, but then also extra ones that you can purchase at minimal cost to really try to protect your family, which I think parents are realizing now is increasingly worth it, just given the kind of level of harms that are out there. So I'm hopeful that we can have a broader cultural shift. And that was, you know, the impetus behind putting out this guide to help parents think better about these issues, and try to spark this movement among parents to say, hey, we're going to take it into our own hands and protect our kids.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because from a parent's perspective, you know, there are certain things like early exposure to pornography, like just small things that have a dramatic effect, can have a dramatic effect on the rest of kids' lives. Early exposure to pornography, the dopamine receptors, the connections that could be totally happenstance to people on other sides of the world that reach out to your child, whatever it is, these are small things that can happen in an instant and have an effect for the rest of your kid's life, just with a phone in their pocket, but also at a friend's house. And so to the extent that, I mean, it feels, again, like Sisyphean, like you're rolling up the boulder up the hill. And unless other kids aren't in the same place as your kid, it almost seems like a losing battle no matter what, to just take your kid off social media when they're spending time at school with friends, et cetera, et cetera. So that makes a lot of sense that parents are much more comfortable probably taking that big step when other parents are doing the same. Is there anything, Claire, we haven't talked about, or anything you think parents maybe don't realize or should absolutely be aware of going forward?
I think we've pretty much covered this well. I will just say, though, the last thing I would just end with is that the thing I want parents to realize is that kids don't need to go looking for pornography or looking for the harmful content the way that you might think. Like, oh, it won't be my child. They won't go out and look for that stuff on the internet. It really finds them on social media. And we were getting at this earlier with the TikTokification. Like, these videos and content are just promoted to them in their feed. So just by the nature of setting up a social media account, these kind of harmful content, potential contacts from these strangers or bad actors out there will just constantly be pouring into kids' phones and feeds. And so I just want parents to be aware, it's, you know, it's not that your kid is necessarily the type of kid who will be looking for it. You really have to be proactive to protect them, because just by nature of being on these apps, that stuff will find them. And I would say that you're right about the kind of network effect. This is something that Jonathan Haidt has talked about, that even social media use by a few kids in a school or organization changes the entire social environment in terms of kids and how they interact. And so I would say, like, if you can find friends who think like you and try to, you know, encourage them to keep their kids off as well. And I think, you know, it just takes one parent to take the initiative and say, hey, this stuff is not good for our kids. Like, let's like keep them off of this. And I think the more parents that are willing to have those conversations with their friends, I think other people are thinking that too, and just don't necessarily know or have the boldness, I guess, to be the first parent to not let their kid have it. And so I think the more we can get parents talking to each other and really trying to say, like, let's help each other protect our kids, I think that that can make a really positive difference. And so just start where you are in your local school, your local neighborhood and community. That's really where this stuff is going to start, because parents are on the front lines. And we can, I think, really make a difference and kind of take back our communities in that way and protect our kids.
And, you know, Claire, I'm sure you get smeared as a liberal by some conservatives from time to time for your policy solutions, the folks that are represented by big tech, et cetera. But I think we're ending in a very conservative place that, you know, probably the most hopeful location going forward lies with the people and with changing the way we live our lives personally. That's not to say your policy solutions aren't good ones. I agree, but we can do so much, you know, just as consumers and just as cogs in the free market wheel in the free market machine to, you know, take back the country, take back our existences from these awful companies. So, Claire, I really, really appreciate it. We will have to do this again. I love picking your brain. I love hearing your insights. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Really enjoyed our conversation.
Absolutely. Well, you've been listening to another edition of the Federalist Radio Hour. I'm Emily Jashinsky, culture editor at the Federalist, joined today by Claire Morrell of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. You can learn more about EPPC at eppc.org. The wonderful guide to raising children in families in the digital era is on their website. You should definitely check it out. We'll be back soon with more Federalist Radio Hour. Until then, be lovers of freedom and anxious for the fray.